As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. From Dudley and McKelvey to the era of Hatzius, Goldman Sachs research has been about acuity. On this Friday, we're going to lose the numbers, the many numbers of Jan Hatzius's work, his team's work, but we're going to go to one number, which is your Q4 number. They've marked down GDP from a sterling 1.3% to sub 1%. That gives you some of the direction of the recession call. But at the same time, Jan Hatzius calls for a shallow recession. If we get a shallow recession, you quantify what it will mean for jobs in America. How does the magnitude of recession work into the dynamics of unemployment?
Yeah, let's just be clear that we don't have a recession in our baseline forecast. We do have significantly below trend growth. 0.9% is only half the long-term trend pace. Mm-hmm. But our best guess is that we'll be below trend. That rebalances the imbalance in the labor market, and that ultimately also helps bring inflation back down. That said, there's a very significant risk of recession. I think it has gone up because it's very difficult to reduce labor demand
right. Without
the deterioration feeding on itself and then ultimately culminating in a recession. So we're giving a 1 in 3 chance of a recession in the next 12 months. And it's close to 50-50, I think, over the next 2 years.
But you've got 2% of unemployment rate baked into a 2001-ish kind of recession.
In 2001, it was a 2 percentage point increase. That was the bottom end of the historical range, if you look at all of the recessions in post-war history. The top end of the range is 5.5 percentage points. I think if we do have a recession, it's likely that it would be on the shallower end for two reasons. One, private sector balance sheets are in better shape than at the end of previous business cycles. And two, I think while inflation is very high, I don't think it's as entrenched, certainly not as entrenched in expectations as it was in previous high inflation episodes, 70s, early 80s.
Jan, we just got off a couple of weeks where people were ratcheting up their expectations for the terminal Fed funds rate to about 4% as of at some point next year. And here we are looking at a huge rally in two-year yields. Can you translate the rally that we have seen through an economics lens in terms of what people are forecasting and whether it seems plausible in your mind?
Well, our forecast is a terminal rate of 3.25% to 3.5%. We think we'll get there by the end of 2022. We don't have any additional rate hikes in 2023, basically because the economy is decelerating, is growing below trend, inflation is coming down, and I think at that level, the Fed would probably hold. You're right, we had priced something around 4%, immediately after the FOMC meeting or right around the FOMC meeting. But I think people have looked at the fact that the economy actually is decelerating, and that has led to a reversal of that. And I think fundamentally, that's appropriate.
But Jan, given the fact that we are seeing a deceleration, but we're not seeing a deceleration when it comes to the inputs into inflation. We're seeing rents continue to climb at a record pace. We're continuing to see some of the disruptions to oil supplies and to food supplies that are causing some of the price increases. When do you start to talk stagflation? When do you start to talk about a Fed that is forced to act despite an unemployment rate that's rising and despite weakening economic data points?
Well, I think it's a little bit more mixed if I look at the inflation indicators. No question, the last CPI and the rent number there was bad. There was an increase in the long-term University of Michigan inflation expectations measure, but the supply chain measures are actually getting better. You look at the supply delivery indices and the business surveys, those are coming down. The wage numbers in 2022 have been sequentially clearly slower than the second half of last year. And I think broadly speaking, inflation expectations, look at just the break-evens in the bond market, are still very well anchored. So I think it's a more mixed picture. And in an environment where growth comes down to a below-trend pace, I just don't think that the Fed would keep hiking aggressively when the economy is already slowing and inflation is already coming down.
So, Jan, essentially what you're saying is that when Chairman Powell was speaking on Capitol Hill yesterday saying that our commitment to fighting inflation is unconditional, that there actually are conditions in which the Fed blinks.
I think there are conditions where the Fed blinks, but it's partly because there is a feedback from economic activity into inflation. If the economy weakens and labor demand declines and maybe the unemployment rate starts edging up, then you're also just going to become less concerned about inflation. So I do think the commitment to ultimately getting back down to 2% is unconditional, but there will be, factors other than the current inflation prints that will sort of drive what they do on a meeting-by-meeting basis.
While we're talking about the specific words that Jerome Powell has used, I've talked earlier in the show about the tweets Bill Ackman posted overnight talking about how the Fed clearly has a credibility problem. The bond market is misreading the Federal Reserve. And what he said is ultimately that comes down to the communication of the chairman. Do you think that Powell and others on the FOMC are accurately communicating to this market what it is they intend to do?
No, I think they are accurately communicating, I think, in ways that are clear, that they do want to get back down to 2% eventually. They're tightening policy aggressively, much more aggressively than they expected to do 6 months ago or 12 months ago, in part because inflation turned out to be much higher. So I think at that level, it's all pretty clear. On the credibility problem, I would also say, look at inflation break-evens. I mean, the credibility from the bond market's perspective or from the perspective of forecasters of the 2% inflation target, right, still seems intact.
Jan, I want to go to Peter Orszag of the London School of Economics and a small banking shop in New York. Peter Orszag loves the phrase glide path. And maybe that's differential equations. But it's Friday. Let's just stay with calculus. Are we completely misjudging the second and first derivative of core inflation coming in where it may come in shockingly rapidly and we underestimate that good news?
I do think that core inflation is likely to come down. In fact, if you look at statistical measures of core inflation, like the trimmed mean index,
Cleveland,
that
Dallas,
has been improving over the last few months. It's still a little too early to tell how
much weight to put on it.
But the last couple of readings have been more encouraging. And I think that does suggest that over time, core inflation is going to come down. And, we're at about 4% for core PCE, core in this case defined as ex food and energy, by the end of the year, and then at about 2.5% by the end of next year. So I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but I think we're headed in that direction.
So when Jerome Powell says we get back to 2% inflation, that's what he's talking about. And Hatzius says Powell will get his wish in 18 months.
Not quite. We're at 2.5, but that's not too far away from 2%.
Yeah, 2 and 2.5. It's TV. Who's counting?
Especially if you look at this as an average inflation target.
Okay,
so at some point there will, whether there's a recession next year or not, our best guess is not, but there will be a recession at some point and that will bring inflation down further.
I should say with great respect, I'm busting Dr. Hatzius's chops. There is a huge difference between 2 and 2.5% in the inflation. game. Jan Hatzius is with Goldman Sachs. Thank you so much for coming in.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Ian Lingen is out of Minnesota in the Carlson School of Finance. It is absolutely definitive, with a tour of duty at Yale as well, and holds court at BMO Capital Markets and writes absolutely the most dense note on fixed income dynamics on the street. We're thrilled he could join us in studio today. Ian, welcome to Bloomberg. I'm going to cut to the chase. Forget about the y-axis, moving yields. Your note right now is on the mystery of the x-axis, as Bullard talks about front loading and that. Give us the nuance to the pro audience of the x-axis dynamic, the first and second derivatives of the time change we're going to see.
Well, I think that this is the most important conversation in financial markets at the moment. It's really the answer to the question, how can Bullard be talking about a 350 terminal rate when the reality is that two-year yields are trading at or below 3%? It really comes down to the 24-month moving window represented by the two-year notes. And effectively what the market is saying is you might hike now, but you're going to have to start cutting much sooner than in prior cycles.
Leave fixed income and go over to Jan Hatzius at Goldman Sachs Economics, where he and I talked about core CPI and the idea that we don't have a real understanding of the rate of change of how core CPI is going to come down. Do you share that uncertainty?
I certainly do. I would add one nuance,
please,
however, and that is all inflation is the same at this moment for the Fed. Headline inflation, core inflation, they've made no distinction. That's interesting because in the past, they would always focus on core inflation over headline because it was less volatile. But the realities of higher energy prices, higher food prices, and the fact that inflation has become the political touchstone at this point makes all inflation equal. And I think that will change, but not until the midterms.
And is peak rates, it's peak yields, have we already gotten past that? Are we basically at a place where you can say definitively that that is an accurate characterization of what we've seen?
Well, that is certainly our call, but I will note that I said the same thing once we got to 320. So at 350, the logic holds a lot better, but the reality is there's going to eventually be demand for 10 and 30 year paper, and we haven't seen the key investor classes of Japan or certain parts of Europe really come in and start buying treasuries yet. And when we do, that will be worth 35 to 45 basis points in tens, and that gets you back below 3%, the curve more inverted, and the market even more worried about a recession.
So, Ian, is this supportive for risk assets if the market is going to get more worried about recession and could potentially have to reduce their estimates for margins and profits?
So that is, again, one of the key uncertainties. I would normally say yes. You have a less aggressive Fed. You have lower rates. You should have a good setup for risk assets. But this Fed is behaving much differently than we might have otherwise anticipated. So we could see the possibility of a recession increase, but the Fed, instead of having the traditional response, just push forward and say, yeah, 3.5, we're going to get there. We might push it into a recession, but the reality is it's worth keeping the decades of hard-won credibility as an inflation fighter for the Fed for this one cycle.
Well, Bill Ackman of Pershing Square says the Fed already has a credibility problem and that the bond market is misreading the Fed. To quote one of his tweets, he said that the market is flat out ignoring Powell and the governor's commentary. Expect even more hawkish commentary until the bond market wakes up. Who's asleep, Ian, Bill Ackman or the bond market?
Well, I'll tell you this much. If you look at break-evens, what you can see is that inflation expectations continue to move lower and lower and lower, and that is a vote of confidence in the Fed's ability to control inflation and forward inflation expectations. So one thing can be said, the TIPS market certainly isn't asleep at the moment.
Well, and Jim Bullard, as we said, have said that the TIPS pricing is pretty much right on at the moment. So as we put all of this together, the market has confidence in the Fed's ability to fight inflation. What it has less confidence in is what the ultimate result of that inflation fighting is, how deep a recession will be when and if one arrives. Ian, what is your assessment of that and ultimately what that means for how low we could see yields going?
So I think that at this point, part of the conversation that isn't occurring in markets is we're just coming off of a negative real GDP print for Q1, which was negative 1.5 after revisions. Right now, GDP for the second quarter is tracking at zero. So if we have a repeat of the higher than expected inflation profile in the U.S., we could actually dip below zero for real growth in the second quarter. And that would make a recession a very near-term event. Caveat, though, that's not the same type of recession that the market is talking about. The market's worried about a real recession with higher unemployment that we actually see an aggregate hit to nominal demand. And that's not where we are yet.
Ian Lingen, part of your world. If you're on radio and television, Ian Lingen of BMO Capital Markets joins us right now. The conversation of the week on fixed income. You and I have never seen these bond losses. And I'm fascinated and honored to ask you this question, which is get away from the nuances. The bottom line is the total return index, the Bloomberg-Lincoln total return index, is negative 12%. How does bond psychology change if people are looking out to 2024, 25, 26 to catch up from these losses?
Well, I think an important aspect of bond losses in the treasury market is to keep in mind who the major players tend to be.
People taking the loss.
A lot of the people taking the loss are indexed or attempting to match their index, but everybody's been short. And so on paper, it's a pretty significant loss, but a good portion of the investment community has fared reasonably well.
Okay, but what about mere mortals? They open up their statement from BMO Capital Markets and go, they start saying profanity about Lincoln. The real world out there, this is a bond market we've never seen. Mm-hmm. It's worse than Volcker's bond market. Mm-hmm.
I think that the person at home opening their statement, what they're really going to be thinking in the back of their mind is, wow, mortgage rates are almost 6%. That might be the problem. So a little bit of pain in terms of the opportunity to invest in higher treasury yields is one thing. But as the ramifications of the Fed's tighter monetary policy continue to push through to the employment and the housing market, I think that's where we start to get worried.
Ian, how much is your peak yields thesis right now hinging on this idea that the inflationary inputs are transitory, that we still have this stealth transitory narrative guiding a lot of investors and even the Federal Reserve?
I think that the peak inflation or the peak rates narrative is actually based more on the hawkishness and the aggressiveness of the Fed. Regardless of how inflation plays out, what we know is that a lot of what has occurred, at least over the course of the last 6 or 8 months, has been a function of distortions created by the pandemic, the supply side on the energy sector, and now food inflation is very material. Fast forward to this time next year, the year-over-year inflation prints will not be as high. That doesn't mean it was necessarily transitory. That either means that the Fed was that much more hawkish or, in fact, prices moderated just based on demand.
Ian, while we're fast forward to 10 a.m. when we get those UMish sentiment numbers, is the bond market going to latch onto more of the pure sentiment read, how bad it is and what that means for growth prospects, or the inflation expectations and what that means as to whether or not the Fed is actually going to have to be more hawkish for longer if that is becoming entrenched in the economy?
I think that the headline consumer confidence figure at record low levels is extremely telling. And when we look at the correlation, it really comes down to gasoline prices and equity performance. And both of those have been going the wrong direction for there to be any additional confidence. I think that we are going to focus on confidence over inflation expectations because the Fed has communicated that they're going to do everything it takes to keep inflation anchored.
Very quickly here, do bonds have catharsis? We think about stocks going down, VIX of 40, et cetera. Does that happen with bonds? Does everybody sell at the same time?
So there does tend to be key moments of capitulation in one direction or the other. And right now, as I mentioned, the vast majority of the market is short treasuries. There'll be a point where people wake up and they say, I don't want to miss out on these higher yields.
Wonderful to see you. I have a lot of message here on Ian's research. Again, we protect the copyright of all of our guests. Find that research at BMO Capital Markets. Ian Lincoln with us. Tina Fordham with us. The futures up 30 right now. Founder and geopolitical strategist Fordham Global Foresight joins us right now. We're thrilled to have her on this morning. Tina, I want to digress to the British elections and the uproar of Mr. Dowden, the Conservative Tory Party leader, resigning at 5:30 in the morning, London time. And I want to go out far west of London on the way out to Cornwall. And this is not the time of poll dark. This is the time of now. And north of Exeter, Tiverton, in lovely Devon, I hope I'm pronouncing everything correctly, and Boris Johnson was absolutely crushed. What is the symbolism that he was crushed in friendly Devon going back to 1935?
Well, it's another blow to this prime minister who, nevertheless, as you will have seen, Tom, has vowed to carry on exactly as he has been. We've had scandal after scandal. The chairman of the Conservative Party, as you've said, resigned this morning in a sternly worded letter. And yet Boris Johnson doesn't seem to have plans to go anywhere. And that tells you a lot about the times that we're living in. There certainly is no shame in politics, no sense of accountability. And as long as the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, is not, a serious challenge, Johnson will probably stay where he is. It's defying the laws of political gravity. By-elections in the UK aren't typically, very, very much participated in. Pollsters will tell you that they're of minor importance. But again, in the face of so many crises that this government is facing, how many times can Boris Johnson get on a plane and go see his friend Zelensky in Kyiv when things are looking tough at home?
Tina, you point to this political gravity or lack thereof that Boris Johnson has and other leaders may have as well, as we face a lot of individuals who want to be heard about the pain that they are feeling in the face of inflation. And that brings us to some of the strikes and some of the protests that we're seeing erupt throughout Europe, throughout the world. What is the hotspot that you're watching and what is the consequence, both politically and economically, that will result?
Well, strikes and inflation go hand in hand, and coming out of the pandemic and probably heading into a recession, and with those workers who are on kind of fixed contracts not having seen a pay rise for a very long time, the old summer of discontent term is being bandied about a lot. You guys were talking about the price of lobster rolls. You know, similarly, I can say that British Airways is threatening, I think, meaningfully here in the UK to start striking as soon as school vacations begin. That's going to be very unpopular. But the question is whether it's going to actually force a compromise in advance. In the UK, this is very acute. France also is known to have strikes, and that will recur. And I guess what I feel is there's a sense of helplessness about this. For so many public sector and other workers, wages have been stagnant through the pandemic, and you know it's just taking inflation to focus minds.
Tina, we talked about lobster rolls tongue-in-cheek because this is the least of our concerns. It's basic staples. It's wheat. It's basic meat. It's all of these other basic groceries and gas prices that are impeding, as Tom said, the lower deciles. How do we look at possible fiscal spending to offset some of the pressures that are very real, very tangible, and a big threat, particularly to the lower-income individuals around the world, in Europe in particular?
Well, of course, the people most acutely affected are the very poorest in EMEA and those who depend on grain supplies that are being blockaded by Russia out of the Black Sea ports. And so that's happening in the Middle East, where there are many concerns, which I've addressed elsewhere, about kind of Arab Spring 2.0 and that sort of thing. In developed countries, we don't get riots or civil unrest in the same kind of way. We get more organized expressions of popular discontent. And that means strikes, of course, and protests. Governments, having responded with so much fiscal largesse during the pandemic, are really going to be expected to step up. And what I think we're already seeing is fuel prices and subsidies for fuel prices are going to come first. Food is a bit more difficult in developed countries, but winter heating, winter fuel allowances, and those kinds of subsidies in the UK and Europe, I think, are just a question of when and not if.
Tina, we only have about a minute left, but as we talk about the economic pain so many countries are feeling, are we going to start seeing a dissolution of the resolve of the allies to continue to support Ukraine, inflict economic pain on Russia when it's inflicting so much economic pain on their own domestic populations in return? Are we reaching that breaking point?
We're not there yet, but at the G7 meetings, the measures that are being contemplated, gas rationing in Germany, for example, the question of whether Russia just flat out, you know, cuts gas supplies to Europe as punishment in what a tactic called coercive diplomacy, it's very real. It'll be winter before we see push come to shove on this, but that's why getting the gas storage facilities in Europe filled is crucial. They have to fight this. They can't give in to Russia. I think leaders understand this. Can they communicate to citizens? The need to make sacrifices is a bigger question, because politicians don't like to take, they like to give.
Tina Fordham, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it, with Fordham Global Foresight.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is an immense joy right now. Shahab Jalanous is Global Head of FX Strategy at Credit Suisse and joins us this morning. And I want to go to the magnitude of your calls. I want to go weak yen, well out past 140. And Swiss franc, we've been watching the last 20 minutes to see if we go through parity. Strong euro Swissy coming down nicely under parity, and you say goes further. Why do we get these magnitude of moves in foreign exchange?
Well, we're seeing the end of the former system of central banks using balance sheets to essentially manipulate where FX rates trade. And as that system frees up, or comes under pressure, you're seeing FX rates react to that. In Switzerland, they're much further ahead than where Japan is right now in making that transition. Japan is trying to stay the course as long as possible. So that's what we're seeing reflected in FX.
So are you calling for a Bretton Woods moment? I mean, is it a big enough shift coming off of balance sheet dynamics that it's a la after World War II and what Keynes and the others did at Mount Washington?
It doesn't need to be as big as that to still have very significant effects for FX investors. Let's put it that way. So, for example, in the Euro-Swiss cross, it's very easy for us to imagine that cross going down to 97, even lower in the weeks to come.
What does it do to a McDonald's hamburger and a Bahnstorf just down from the Credit Suisse office? Asking for a friend.
Yeah, it's a good idea to think about those things. I guess they will get more expensive, but that's not something that is worrying the S&P at this point. So,
Lisa, that top ticks out at $20 for a number two value meal.
I'm sure that there is some personal experience wrapped in there. I can't figure it out, but I think that's my hunch. Shahab, I wonder how much you're looking at peak yields, as we were just hearing from Mike Bell of JP Morgan. And how much does that mean peak dollar, right? How much are these two measures really trading in tandem?
Well, look, it's definitely been the case that rate differentials and the U.S.'s much higher yields have been helpful for the dollar. But to be honest, I think there's more to the dollar story than just yields. For example, on the trade side, there's been very big shifts in trade dynamics that really need to be recognized. So, for example, right now we have the euro area with a trade deficit. We have Japan moving rapidly in the same direction as well. So currencies like the euro and the yen that historically were backed by trade surpluses, current account surpluses, the whole energy price shift and the terms of trade shift has really changed that dynamic materially. And meanwhile, on the U.S. side, you have record exports at this point. There's going to be nearly $200 billion of just agricultural exports in this fiscal year, according to projections from that side of the story. So when you put all that together, to me, there's more to the dollar strength story than just rate differentials at this point.
This is a really important point. How does this translate into some of the big crosses, whether it's euro parity or just in general, how strong the dollar can get?
Well, I think the dollar right now looks strong compared to the last 3 to 5 years, that's for sure. But I think if you go back much further, the dollar has been a lot stronger for a variety of reasons. And the key point I would make is, it's not the same dollar as the last time euro dollar was at 105. You know, when you have euro now with trade deficits as a problem, you basically need capital inflows into the euro area on a net basis if you're going to have a current account deficit. And that's something that has been missing. The euro has been a capital exporter for many, many years. So there's a new value proposition that the euro needs to offer at this point in time, simply to avoid going down. And I think that's absent right now.
Well, let's move from Europe to the island just next to it. We had UK consumer confidence data earlier today showing a record low, the lowest in 48 years of data, clearer concern around inflation, the cost of living, the possibility of a recession. How does that feed through to your view on sterling?
We think sterling is still going to go lower. We are looking for a test of 120 on cable again, and eventually a move through that level. The problem for sterling, really, you still have that same trade story developing that I mentioned for the euro area in Japan. It's not like years of a weak pound have created big trade surpluses or very competitive UK exports. That just hasn't happened for a variety of reasons. And so you have a currency that doesn't really have any reason to go up right now. Even when you think about the Bank of England, the market is pricing in 50 basis point hikes consecutively for a few meetings ahead of us. And yet the Bank of England is constantly pushing back against that narrative and makes it very difficult to realize what's already priced in. So when you put those factors on the table, sterling is still going to go lower.
Shaab, I got like 8 more questions. You got to go, but you know, please come back soonest as you can. These are some abrupt calls here from Shaab Jalan. It's a different landscape out there for all of us investors, including Jerome Powell, with the kind of moves that Credit Suisse is talking about. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.